What does your idea of happily ever after look like?
What a great question. I think happy is a relative term. I think happy means something different to everybody. To me, based on my experience, I think happy and fulfillment are similar. So it might not feel good, but being fulfilled is part of the ever after goal. And I try and live every little thing that I do kind of compiles up to the ever after. Moving toward fulfillment, right? So being in alignment with my values, having integrity, things like that. I think if you can live that way pretty consistently, then that's kind of my definition of happily ever after.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Anahata Mehta about her memoir and modern dating guidebook, 52 Weeks, 52 Dates. This book feels like part social experiment and part chronicle of the chaos of finding love. What was the intention behind it when you began?
Well, I always say, like, I never intended to write a book. It kind of happened by accident because it was kind of divinely inspired. So I thought it might be funny if I started dating and then wrote about it, and I wasn't entirely sure. And then I went on the first date and wrote about it, and I just thought it was so hysterical that I had to keep going. So I think originally the idea was I want to try and manifest this idea. Like, I'm having an idea, and I want to see what would happen if I follow through with it. And I think at the time, I never really had done that before. Like, I had never really taken an idea and make it happen. I wasn't familiar or comfortable with risk taking in that way. The cool thing about I sometimes refer to it as the project, the project, is that, you know, it involved my favorite subject material, which is people and relationships. And so it became kind of an interactive process, telling the story, writing the story, not really knowing where the story would go, and hoping that through that process, I would learn something through the spontaneity of that process.
The back of the book proclaims, "This story charmingly explores and sheds light on a world that no other guidebook can help you navigate in such an honest, vulnerable way." So the book is called 52 Weeks, 52 Dates. In what way is this a guidebook?
Well, I think when you say the first thing that comes to my mind, when you say no other book can do this in such an honest and vulnerable way, the first thing that comes to my mind is, because no one's that stupid to do this. I'll just say that I think through this, writing this book, I found out that my superpower is being authentic and being vulnerable. And so I feel like the cost benefit of being that vulnerable is hopefully for the benefit of others. I think that my perspective, the filter that I write through, or the filter that I kind of see things through, is directed towards finding patterns, towards having a greater understanding of this construct that we call dating or that we call love, that has largely been completely renovated in the last decade. I mean, it's just nowhere near the same. And I'm in this weird kind of age group where I'm not young enough to forget, you know, what life was like before cell phones existed, before technology existed. But I'm also in the age group that uses it to find romance pretty regularly. And it's also written from, you know, a woman's perspective. There's some other books that are out there that kind of address this topic, but they're written in a way that's probably more entertainment. And this is kind of more like a soul searching, trying to discover the broad lessons through the lens of a social scientist, so to speak.
Right.
It's funny because when I picked up this book, I was like, oh, this will be some light reading, you know. And the front, for listeners who can't see, is like 52 cartoon faces of dudes and like this contemplative woman. And pretty quickly, I discovered that this was not the journey I had signed up for in reading this, pleasantly so. Mm-hmm. In terms of lessons, you're speaking about a relationship meditation and you say the lesson is in the mess. Mm. Can you define that?
Yeah. Many of the listeners probably have heard of another social scientist named Brené Brown. She'd had this explosive TED Talk called The Power of Vulnerability. And I actually watched that before I started the project, and I think it really informed some of that process. We like to control and predict. That's what humans do. And we don't always do it consciously, but we do it in such a way where we can try and understand what's going on around us. The problem is the only thing we can control is ourselves. No matter how hard we try, no matter how much we want to control other people are going to do stuff that we don't understand. And there's, you know, two ways of looking at that. You can either take it as, you know, I'm going to try and manipulate the situation and get what I want, or you can just take it for what it is. The path of that is largely individual. Being able to understand yourself and understand how you relate to other people in this mess, I think, is where the lesson is. It's a little bit of a spiritual bent. Mm-hmm. I don't think everyone is, as like you said, contemplative around relationships. But for those of us that are, that's kind of what it's speaking to.
One of the compassing elements, it seems like, are a series of questions that you write in the beginning of the book. And I was wondering if you would just read those for us.
Here are some questions I have concerning emotions generated by a man I would like to pursue a relationship with. Do I feel at ease and relaxed? Does he laugh at my jokes? Can we communicate our ideas concerning intellectual matters that are important to me? When I reveal my true feelings, are they handled with care or are they deflected? Does he regard me with respect and compassion, or am I disposable to him? As I become more comfortable and open, does he also, or does he begin to withdraw? In the past, no matter how I answered these questions, I could still find a reason to stay involved with someone who didn't respect or care for me and treated me like I was disposable. Disposable. The definition of disposable is intended to be used once and then thrown away. I want to examine this concept in terms of others treating me as disposable and me treating others as disposable. I will start by saying that I have spent a lifetime treating others as disposable objects. I have been afraid to be selfless. I have had a hard time functioning in the world without desperately seeking approval and someone to inflate my ego. I have not been very good historically at giving to others, emotionally or otherwise.
How did you come up with those questions?
So date number 7 was what prompted those questions, going out with date number 7. And there was kind of this respect. He really had this energy of respect for me. By date number 7, I was kind of getting into the swing of things. Like, it had become part of my routine. So like every Friday night, I would go out on the date, and then Saturday, and then I'd sleep. Something magical would happen in my brain. And then Saturday I'd start writing, and I'd continue to write until pretty much Saturday night. And then Sunday I'd spend all day editing it. And so it was kind of a weekend deal, one date at a time. So by that point, you know, I kind of had like a little bit of a rhythm going, and I was starting to notice that everybody brought their own first impression to the table. It's interesting because when I talk to people about online dating, a lot of times they're like, I don't want to do it. I'm too afraid. There's nobody good out there. I mean, all the cliche stuff, right? Like, all the good ones are taken, mm-hmm. stuff like that. But at that point, date number 7, I had started to realize that, like, I was a witness to whatever this person was putting out there. The impression that I got from him was that he was kind of willing and open to just be. He was just kind of there to have a good time. Mm-hmm. We met for tea. We went to have sushi, even though he was a vegetarian. Yeah. And he was okay with that. And then we started playing pool, and there was this really easy back and forth. I think when I talk to people about dating and they talk about how they couldn't do it, they don't know how to date, you'd be so surprised. A lot of people will just come out and say, I've never really dated.
Yeah.
Like, I've never had the experience of going out with different people. I don't want to sound too cheesy, but like, it was this kind of sweet little puddle of like experience where it was like, what did I feel when I was with this person? Yeah. Because this person wasn't very pushy. They didn't really have an agenda. They seemed to be pretty comfortable with just hanging out. What does that mean in terms of how am I going to use my own discretion? Because I think the other hard thing about dating for at least people who have problematic relationships is this desperation for wanting to be liked so badly that they'll pretty much attach to anybody. And so this idea that it doesn't have to be forced or there doesn't have to be pressure around it, that I can actually make a decision based on how I feel about this other person was a revelation. Yeah. And I think it was highlighted by the fact that I had been on so many dates already, mm-hmm. and then I was specifically writing about it. And that's why I felt like I wanted to get it out there. It's not just a diary. There's a format to this process that allows for introspection that's a little different than just chatting with your friends, right. Because it's a whole series of a process.
So what I think most readers or listeners would be surprised by is that although the book begins as a sort of catalog of okay to mediocre to very bad dates, it settles into this narrative about unfolding connection. And at one point in the book, you describe, this book was originally intended to navigate the crazy world of dating, which turned into the crazy world of me, which turned into the crazy world of us. So can you give us, just paint the picture of how the book shifted?
By the time I got to that line, I was feeling like, what am I doing? It had become so deep in terms of what I was learning that I kind of got into a fog. I mean, it was a challenge to do it every single week with no break, to write that much, to meet that many new people. And like I said, I didn't have a plan in terms of what the outcome was going to be. There was a part of me that wanted it to be fiction. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write this story of how this way of living, being vulnerable, being authentic, telling the truth, exploring my own sense of self, that it had some type of happy ending. The process of coming into those questions and understanding myself was largely unpredictable. At that point when I wrote that line, I was like, well, gosh, that sucks. Like, that's not what I wanted. I wanted like a clean, wrapped right. up, ta-da, I know something. And I did not know anything. So when I wrote that, that was where it was coming from. And then, you know, you go through the rest of it, and I don't want to give away too much of the story, but I will say this. One of the reasons that it's so meaningful to me is that I sat on this material for a really long time before I published it. So I finished writing it 5 years ago.
Wow.
Part of the reason I didn't publish it was because it was scary. But the other reason was like, I wanted to make sure that that mess that I was about to put out there was going to be able to convey the message of, even when it doesn't work out the way you want it to, there's value in that. Substantial, hardcore value around doing the next right thing, being spontaneous, being honest. I can really holistically say that that has happened to me over and over and over and over again. Coming from a very research-oriented academic background, I wanted to make sure that this wasn't just an emotional fly-by-night right. advice book.
Right.
I wanted to see that, can this formula, this is what I talk about, these questions, these ideas, can this formula of living this way actually produce a better quality of life, a more fulfilling life? I can honestly say yes. It sometimes doesn't feel that way.
Yeah.
It doesn't always feel good. But, you know, the relationships that I have as a result of going through this experience today are real. All of them. Every single one. And it actually, when I go to sleep at night, you know, when I wake up in the morning, when I think about that cliche question about when you're on your deathbed, what are you going to think about? What do you regret? I don't have any. That means a lot to me, because when I started writing the book, or even during the middle of the book, I felt very trapped inside this experience of relationship that I didn't know how to connect with other people, or I didn't feel okay, or I felt awkward, or I felt self-conscious. There's a freedom in the lessons of this book that I stand by, and I'm willing to put it out there and say, like, yeah, I'm not perfect. It's a little wild and crazy in there, but it's something that I wouldn't trade for anything.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Anahata Mehta about her nonfiction account, 52 Weeks, 52 Dates. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the second half, Anahata will step into the shoes of men trying to navigate the tough world of online dating. I was wondering, there are points when, you know, as the writer, you could have made the narrator sound more flattering or cleaner or something, and you didn't. You kept going straight towards the rawness. How did you trust yourself?
Well, that's kind of what I meant when I said I discovered this superpower, or I'm really stupid. It's hard to tell. When I talk about the story writing me, and it writing itself, how seemingly effortless it was to do it, taking these risks. Really, at the end of the day, it's about how can other people relate to it? I don't know if you remember. I was pretty young when it came out, but I remember there was this book called The Rules.
Oh.
Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. I think they were Southern. Don't quote me on that. I don't mean to be regionalist, but I think they were two Southern women, and they had written a book on how to get a man to marry you, to date you, to like you, whatever. And you had to follow all these rules. Things like don't call right away, don't call back right away, make sure you don't sleep with him on the first date. And I think that that is just a big myth. Mm-hmm. I think it's a big disservice to our community as humans that we have to pretend to be something we're not to be liked. Like I said, my experience with writing this book changed my life to the point where I have found that even in the mess, even in the most insecure moments, the skill of being able to be authentic and honest is what breeds connection. Mm-hmm. And that's largely what Brené Brown's message is. If you can be vulnerable, you can also feel worthy. What on earth? What a concept.
Right.
Paradox City. It's so interesting. And what's even more interesting is that as someone who feels like I'm not the only one that lives this way, but it does take a lot of practice and it takes a lot of willingness. Most people have not had interactions in that way. Sometimes when I can just be myself and be honest and be disarming in a lot of ways. It's really disarming to be around somebody like that who has those qualities. Because I've continued to do online dating. I've even upgraded to newer technology like Tinder. Uh-huh. And I've met so many people. I say I have a black belt in Tinder.
Yeah.
you know, I can meet people and I can be myself. It's just amazing the response you get when you are disarming in that way, and people really enjoy it. Some people who maybe are afraid to be themselves or are very self-conscious, nervous, when they get to interact with me and I'm being myself, they get permission to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the contagion I'd like to see. Paradoxically, the more we can show our weakness or our vulnerability, the stronger we are, which is really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. There was an NPR story recently about the commodification of dating and online. And so I'm thinking about you holding these two poles, which is how to be your most authentic self through a medium that promotes self-disguise. What is the advice you have for those that are in the fray?
When I did this project, I did OkCupid because Tinder wasn't around back then. I have become a Tinder lover because, yes, on some level it is based on appearances to a certain extent. And I like to point out that as social animals, it's always based on appearance. Even if you meet someone in person, that's how we get attracted to each other. The medium of Tinder is actually blank slate-ish. When you sign up for any of these online things, you don't commit to having a relationship with this person or liking this person or having children with this person or having sex. None of that. It's just a medium to put one person in touch with another. Mm-hmm. That's the cool part, because you can, and I do, make up my own rules. That's the vulnerability part that is so valuable in participating in your own life. Yeah, there's a script, or there's a imposed cultural norm of what's expected, but there's no one enforcing it. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. That's the beautiful part about technology these days. We have access. Now, this is going to sound kind of bizarre, but we have access to be vulnerable in a way that we didn't have before. Because I don't have to go to a bar, actually, to find someone to be real with. All I have to, it's so easy. All you have to do is swipe right and ta-da, there it is. Where that person is in their journey versus where I am in my journey, there's some very interesting mathematical equation as to how many possible connections we could have, right? But generally speaking, being able to see it as we can create our experience together. Most guys that are on there, most, I would say, are aware of the fact that women are going to see them as kind of predatory. They know that. They're not stupid. They know they have to be careful about what they say and how they say it. And it doesn't have to be that way. We don't have to follow the script that is written for us. We can make it whatever we want. And that brings us to the idea of consent. I love this. I think it's really interesting I get to talk about this book when we're dealing with all these consent issues. That's really important, that as a empowered, freedom-oriented woman who's single going out on dates, it is absolutely always 100% my right to say yes or to say no. There's no terms and conditions that meeting someone implies anything. We get to not only examine how that functions in the world and in this time of technology, but also the courage that it takes to do that. That's a huge part of it. You have to be willing to be judged. When you're on a date with a guy who is maybe not super evolved and doesn't quite recognize that there's no guarantee, you have to be willing to say no and be okay with that. And I think that's really important for development of self. How do we pick who we want to spend our time with, how we want to spend our time with them? And I think Tinder, in particular, is very good for that, because it makes it more easy, more convenient than it's ever been. We get to say what's okay and what's not. Tinder doesn't get to say.
It's just the forum.
What
is the first step you would recommend to becoming more real?
Acknowledge that you're going to be tempted to not be real. I teach, or I've taught social psychology classes, and one of the things we talk about is how can you inoculate yourself or guard yourself against being taken advantage of? Mm-hmm. Or how can you inoculate yourself or protect yourself from taking advantage of others? And the answer is, know that you're capable of it.
Yeah.
How do you not hurt people? Know that you're capable of hurting others.
Yeah. One of my worries was that you would get a lot of trolls, you know, people coming after you online and, I don't know, harassing you just because it's so raw and vulnerable. Have you had any of that?
I haven't. And I like to think that there is somewhat of a protective nature around authenticity.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I'll tell you a true story. It had occurred to me a week before I published it, that was possible.
Right.
And I freaked out. I was like, oh God, what am I doing? I can't put this out, or I can put this out here, but this is what I'm exposing myself to. Uh-huh. And so there was a friend of a friend, acquaintance, who had a reputation for being pretty abrasive and criticizing. And so it started, and it started to happen. Things like, did you pay for any of these dates? This is you taking advantage of them, things like that. And I just told the truth, mm-hmm. which was that I haven't done an official count and I keep meaning to, but actually most of the people that I wrote about did know about it. The ones that I wrote about more than once actually knew from the beginning.
Right.
And there's this interesting thing about paying anyway, where men are not, you'd be surprised, they're not as against being written about as you would think. I was surprised. And they still paid. They're like, yes, I know you're writing and I'm still going to pay. And I was like, okay, that's part of it too. Being able to say, yeah, I realize that there's the possibility for misinterpretation. I understand that relationships, dating is a hot topic for a lot of people, especially people who have been hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to explain what the method to this madness was, explain what I got from it, explain the benefit of it. That's the best I can do. And then a week later, this person who had been writing all this stuff came back to me and said, you know, I just really wanted to apologize for dumping all that on you, because actually it was all of my baggage around wow. women that I had to look at. And I was like, sweet, awesome. I don't know if I say it directly in the book, but part of what I learned was, just because I don't get what I want doesn't mean the relationship has to end. And it doesn't mean that there's not something of value there. That process of being able to take each other's perspective and be able to really communicate through conflict is so rich with meaning. There's so much meaning in that. That's kind of how I try and live my life.
Anahata Mehta just moved back to California. Look for more information about her and her book at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.